Vince Spady. He is a minister out of Soldotna, Alaska, and he's come out several times to Accutane to bless our church. I'm Pastor Matthew. This is Safe Harbor Church, and I just hope that you are encouraged as we listen to part two with Vince Spady.
And so they got through it okay, and so they were, but they had no idea what happened to me. Well, when they saw me up there, they ran up there, and I was about one third of the river out from them, which was probably 40, 50 feet. And they waded out as far as they could wade up to their waist, and then or less, and they threw the rope out to me, and I was able to hang onto the rope, and as soon as I let off the rock, it swung me around to the shore where I was able to stand up. Anyway, that was my first time that the Lord actually saved my life. It was only a few weeks later that we heard that a young man who worked at the local grocery store had floated down that river, fallen out of the boat, and he did not survive. So I knew that God had protected me. Well, the very next fall, wouldn't you know it, I'm back. We're teaching school. We had come to Alaska, and it was in late October, and the temperature had dropped down to 20 below zero, and the river was freezing up fast. The Kuskokwim River is about probably a quarter of a mile wide there at Sleep Mute, and Mary Lil and I had been asked to join a family that lived across the river and about a mile up from where we lived. And because there was a public health dentist in town and his assistant who was working on the Eskimo kids' teeth there, he had invited them for dinner and asked Mary Lil if we could come over and join him after school was out. And so we got in. We had a little boat. I believe it was 12 foot, maybe 14 foot. And I had a little 7.5 horsepower motor that I had hung on the back of that boat. And so we made it up river, zigzagging, missing all the ice, big ice pans coming down, some of them as big as a house going around them, and got over there, had dinner. And it was time to come home about 10 o'clock at night, and we had to cross that river in the dark to get back on the Sleep Mute side where our school was, where we lived. And so the dentist and the dental assistant says, "Oh, Vince, can we ride back across with you?" And I thought, boy, our boat's pretty small to put two more in, and I don't know. And I thought, well, I guess so. We'll be careful. So with me in the back driving the boat, John and Helmy David in the middle seat, and Mary Lil in the front of the boat, we started out across that river in the dark. But Mary Lil had a flashlight, one of those old police flashlights with about five or six batteries in it long, those big batteries, shining it on the ice so that I could steer in between all the ice. We had made it more than halfway across that river, probably two-thirds of the way, and Mary Lil had to move back away from the front. She said the water was splashing up over the front, getting her wet. So she moved back to the middle seat. So the middle seat was pretty crowded with three people there, and somehow that might have upset the way the boat sat in the water or something, I don't know what, but all of a sudden, Mary Lil goes, "Vince, there's water coming in," and all four of us stood up, and as we stood up, it pushed the boat down, and the boat just sunk out from under our feet, and four of us were swimming in ice-cold water, 20 degrees below zero, in the dark, trying to make it to the other shore. So we were able to swim and keep going. We got up on one big pan of ice, and I thought that was the shore. We all crawled out, and I looked at the trees going by over on the side. I could barely see them in the light of the moon. And I said, "You know what, guys? We are not on shore. We're on an ice floe. We're still going." So we walked across that, about 30 feet across that ice floe, had to get back in and swim another 100 feet or so in the current and then through the ice. Well, lo and behold, God allowed all four of us to make it to the ice, edge of the ice, where I broke ice with my elbows for 20 feet to get on some solid ice. We could walk in, and walked a quarter of a mile down to the village finally knocked on a door where some people, some friends were home, and they let us come in and warm back up. So that was the second time that God had miraculously saved us from the deep waters. And I didn't give credit even to God then. I just thought, well, we were lucky that we were saved, not realizing that it was actually God taking care of us. And then the reason this verse is special to me, it's been a couple other times, just you wouldn't think a person would have that much trouble with water, but he also saved me from the fire. I'll just jump ahead to about 2000 or 2001. I'm not sure which year it was. Living in Sleetmute, I was taking a teaching job over at Pedro Bay, Alaska. That's on Lake Iliamna. And I was retired from teaching by that time. But we still had a little airplane. I was teaching for a teacher that had been, they had done a little administrative change. One and the teacher in that village had bumped up to an administrator, and so it was a two-teacher school. So I took over his class. He taught the 7th through the 12th graders, and I would fly home. I would teach Monday through Friday, and then fly home on Friday afternoon for the weekend. Sunday afternoon, I'd fly back about a hour and a half to two hours, depending which way I went. Flight home across Cook Inlet to our, so I could be home with my family for the weekend. Well, that particular day, it was May 6th, toward the end of the season, one more week of school left, and I took off, made it through the Alaska Range, and made it along Cook Inlet, and I had to fly north for about 50 miles before I crossed over to Soldotna, Alaska, Kenai and Soldotna, where we lived. Well, I was up at 7,000 feet, just feeling fat and happy, and all of a sudden, my engine broke, made a terrible sound and rattling sound, and a big fire broke out, caught the spark plug, I think, lit the gas line on fire, and had a huge fire in the front of my cabin, and I immediately put that plane in a dive and thought, I've got to get down. I could see a little beach off ahead of me, and I thought I could make it to that beach and then jump out and be all right if I don't burn up before then. By the time I'd lost about 3,000 feet, the flames they were coming in the cabin, smoke would fill it. So I turned the latch on the door, and I opened my door on my pilot side in flight, and it was a swing up type door, and the wind at 100. I had it in a dive doing about 150 miles an hour in this old airplane, and it ripped the door right off its hinges, and it did suck all the smoke out, and I could see straight down to where I needed to land. And so I remember about halfway down, by that time I was a believer, and I said, Lord, can you help me? I don't want to die today. My plane's burning up, and please help me get down. And before I got all the way down, it had caught my floorboard on fire. My pants were on fire. The fire was going up. It burned up all my radios underneath. And then at the last part, I'm getting with only about 1,000 feet more to go, the flames started coming up right where the yoke was, that your steering yoke that you pull back and forth and turn left and right. And it was burning my hand, so I'd only put one hand in at a time because I had to keep flying the airplane. I had to keep it in control. And I flew it all the way down to the shore, and then I decided instead of land on the beach, I'm going to land off in the water of Cook Inlet to put this fire out, because I didn't want all that gasoline crashing on me. Plus, I had two extra 5-gallon cans of gas behind me in the back seat. Didn't want them to catch on fire. I knew it would be over. So when I landed on the water, a couple skips because of the speed that I had, the plane flipped upside down, and I was able to release my seatbelt and crawl out that open door that was missing. And once again, I said, well, thank you, Lord. I am still alive. And so that was three times the Lord saved me out of the deep water. Well, wouldn't you know it, there was even a fourth time. About 5 years ago, I was flying a float plane that we have, and I had promised to take my friend Jason Elam, who was a kicker for the Denver Broncos for, gosh, I don't know, 13 years or something like that. But he had moved up and become my neighbor, and he had asked me if I would take some of his friends out for a float plane ride, who were from North Carolina. And I said, sure, I can do that, but I'm not on floats yet. But to meet their time schedule, I only had a few days, so I was in a big rush to get our airplane changed from the wheels to the floats, and it needed an annual inspection, so that's you tear a lot of things apart and make sure everything's safe on them. And I did that, and I was in such stress over it that the morning I took off from Kenai Airport over to a little lake where a friend would lifted up the plane up on a hoist and take off the wheels and bolt on the two floats like a couple canoes on each side, but they're enclosed. And the morning I flew over there, I looked at the wind on that lake, and I circled around the lake. I was going to land on a little runway right beside it. Well, in my stress or what, I somehow came in and made an approach to that lake that I had landed on many times on floats, and I made a perfect landing, skidded across the water, but I was on wheels, not floats, not even realizing it. The plane skidded across the water for a ways until the wheels dug in, and then all of a sudden it flipped upside down, broke my windshield completely out of the car, and I'm upside down in an airplane in the dark. And I had to release my seatbelt and get the untangle from the wires, make it out the door, go back up to the surface and get fresh air before I drowned. And, well, the Lord saved me for that. I knew how to swim, so I swam to shore unharmed. Mostly hurt my pride, but once again, I could just say, God, you keep saving me. Every one of those situations, and many other people have died doing similar things, but You've been there for me. And so I could go on and on and just tell you stories, but I just want to say this, you know, if you think that God isn't involved in your life, He knows you, everything about you. He wants to trust you and be your God. And all you have to do is talk to Him, say, yes, Lord, thank you. I realize I'm not just an accident of nature. I was created by you, and you want to care for me and guide all my steps. And you know, I have a lot of friends I've talked to, and they say, listen, I just want to run my own life. I don't want to give my life to Jesus. I only have this one life to live. But I can tell you this, when you give your life to the Lord, He will make it way more satisfying, way more fun, way much purpose and peace in it than you ever thought you could have by yourself without the Lord. He'll help you in situations. You can ask Him to anything as small as find something that you're looking for, because He knows where everything is, as to something, make a major big decision in your life. When you believe in Him, He will send, the Bible tells us too, and I proved it true. He sends His Spirit, and His Spirit lives right inside you, and He'll, not that I hear voices, but a lot of times I pray about it, and I just know what to do. He puts it on my mind or my heart, where to go, who to talk to, what to do, and who wouldn't want a helper like that in life? And He also says, it's kind of one of my favorite verses. It's in the Psalms. I forget exactly where, but it says, trust in me with all your heart, or something like that, and I will give you the desires of your heart. So if there's something that you've been wanting to do or make it, give it to the Lord, and if the Lord wants you to have it, He'll help you attain it. If you don't make that him, the Lord's got something better for you. And it's hard to imagine just how he can be involved in every little thing, but he is that great God. And, you know, and so if you just think about how big is he, how could God do all that? But if he's big enough to make this whole universe and the faraway stars and planets out there, and he also knows about the tiny atoms and tiny cells, is he not capable of taking care of you? You know, look at your own, just look at your own body, all those different systems in it. It's from our blood system to our bone system to our mind, just the way everything works. It's a marvelous creation. All of that didn't happen by accident. And some of my friends that don't believe in God, and they say, no, we're an atheist. We don't believe in all that God stuff. And I say, well, you mean, so you think that the world and our solar system came in existence by a big explosion? And they say, yeah, that's what they believe. And I said, I just tell them, well, you know what? I don't have enough faith to believe that. I believe that just like this building I'm sitting in right now, it was created. It didn't just happen without someone making it. And the same is true of the way the Earth travels around the sun at just the right speed so that gravity doesn't pull it in and it doesn't go too fast that it flies off into outer space. And everything there is just a miracle of God. Well, I don't know. I've just been talking away here. I hope you've enjoyed this. I didn't know. Matthew left me in charge here just to share some stories with you. That's what I'm doing. I expected him to come back in here any minute and say, well, your time is up. But that hasn't happened yet. So that was all I kind of thought of that I was going to share with you. I could share with you, just to show you how God is involved. I'll back up to when you'll like this story. Before we came to Alaska, Mary Lou and I were in Montana, and she had just finished up teaching certificate in Bozeman, Montana at the university there. And I had taught school 1 year in a little town called White Sulphur Springs, Montana. And so we had moved back to Bozeman that year for her to finish her last classes. We had signed some contracts to teach in a little village in Montana that the year coming up. And it was called Lima, Montana, kind of near Dillon, close to Yellowstone National Park, if you can know where that might be. And we were all set to go there. But way back on St. Patrick's Day, and this was part of God's plan, he had sent two men from Alaska down to the States to travel around Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, the Northwest states mostly, to find some teachers to teach out in the bush schools of Alaska. And they came to Montana, and I had talked Mary Lillen into riding over there with me. I said, let's go interview with those guys. And she said, nah, I don't think so. And I said, Mary Lillen, I said, Helen is a big city. They've got restaurants there, not just one in town, and we could go watch a movie at the movie theater. She said, well, that sounds pretty good. So that talked her into it, and we went over, and I talked with these guys and interviewed with them, and for them to get me interested in Alaska, I had told them I liked hunting and fishing, and he said, would you like to see a picture of a moose that I shot last year? And I said, sure. So he said, our time was up for our interview, but he ran out to the car, came back in with a photo album, and he had this huge 60-some-inch spread moose that he had shot over near Valdez. And he turned the page, and he was holding up a king salmon that he caught with his arm through the gills. He, standing up, the tail touched the ground. It weighed over 100 pounds, but he couldn't enter it in the sport fishing book because it was caught on commercial gear that you sell, not sport gear. But And I was a man, that's an amazing place. And but we didn't hear from him in a month, like he said. And so I kind of, we had given up on Alaska, but God had not given up on us. One superintendent from Alaska tried to hire us to come to another village, but excuse me, but we had to, but it didn't work out because we had moved to Bozeman and was living in an apartment, some friend's apartment, and we had using their phone number, and we didn't have a forwarding address yet. Excuse me. And so he gave up and said, well, I can't find that couple that's on our list of people to hire. But another superintendent who was from the Kuskokwim tried to find Mary Lill, and he said, well, I'll find him. He sent a telegram. Now, that surely dates us. You guys, most of you probably don't even know what a telegram is, but it's something you could send in the old days. And it didn't require mail, and it didn't require a phone number. And it would send technically by wire, and then they had a guy deliver the telegram. So I'm out in front of our apartment, and this is like about the month of June, and we had long since signed contracts. But this guy, he says, I have a telegram for Vince Spady. And I said, well, I'm Vince Spady. And he gave it to me, and we opened it and read it. And it said, offer two to teach at Sleep Mute, Alaska. And the salaries that we were going to get paid was literally twice what we were going to make in Montana. And we were going to be teachers of a two-teacher school. And I had a few extra thousand added on for being principal and doing the paperwork in this two-teacher school. And I said, Mary Lill, that sounds really good. And she said, well, that'd be fine, except we've already signed contracts. And she says, when you sign a contract, you honor it. And I knew she was right, but it was still just weighing heavily on me. And so I went to work the next day at lifeguarding at the pool. And she went to class to take her classes. And after class, she gets out of school. She's driving down the boulevard to go shopping at the grocery store. Well, lo and behold, a car passes her. She's in the right lane, and the car passes her in the left lane, gets in front of her, and slows down and turns into the same shopping center where she's going. And she sees it park, and so she parks near it, and she says she sees this young couple get out. They're a little bit older than us. And so she goes, and she says, excuse me, I see you have Alaska on your license plate. Are you guys from up there? And they say, oh, yeah, we're from Alaska. And she said, well, my husband and I were just offered some contracts to teach up there. And they go, oh, really? Where are you going to teach? Where are you supposed to teach? And she said, well, it's just a little village. It's called Sleep Mute. And they go, oh, you're going to take Dave and Jill Markoff's place. They're friends of ours. They're moving over to Northway. And Mary Lill ended up talking with this couple, I think, about an hour and a half. And they told her everything about Alaska and how much fun it was and how adventurous it is. And Mary Lill came home. She says, Vince, guess what? I just met these folks. I want to see if we can get out of those contracts and go to Alaska. I said, well, all I can do is call and see. And but since it was still June and school wasn't till September, the superintendent of that district said, well, I'll let you go to Alaska. I'd rather you be there than be in my school wishing you were in Alaska. So he gave us the okay to go, and we called Alaska. So that was just God's first step in getting us there. And so what an adventure it was being there. I have unbelievable fun stories of going hunting. We weren't there very long. And I think it was after the first of the year. We stayed through Christmas out in the village. And I noticed a lot of teachers up and down the Kuskokwim River in other villages scattered probably every 20 miles or more apart there. And anyway, most of those teachers had an airplane, a little two-seater, a four-seater, or something they could get back and forth, because other than that, the only thing you had was a boat in the summertime on this big river to go up and down the river, or a snowmobile, that they call them snow machines in Alaska, or to go up and down on a snow machine. So other teachers stop in. They say, "Hi, we just wanted to meet you. We're on our way to go to Anchorage for the weekend." And they could fly in a little airplane for 2.5 hours, be through the range, and go in on a Friday, spend the Friday night and Saturday night, and then fly home on a Sunday and fill your airplane full of groceries and things you need and get out of the village once in a while. So I says, "Mary Lilt, you know what we need?" She says, "What's that?" I think she was thinking another boat or snow machine or something. And I says, "We need an airplane." She goes, "Yeah, I was thinking the same thing." And she says, "But we don't know how to fly." And I said, "Well, we could figure it out." And so here's what happened. I was sharing around that, and the fellow across the river who ran the store from us, he had two airplanes. One was a Super Cub, a little two-seater, and the other one was a four-seat Cub. It's called a family cruiser, a Piper. It's basically a Piper Cub, but it's widened out into four seats with two sit in the front. There are two sticks in the front, and you could seat two in the back. And he wanted to sell that airplane to get him a faster Cessna 185, which for his air taxi would suit him better. So he says, "Well, why don't you buy my PA-14? And I didn't know a PA-14 from a PA-2 million, but we agreed to buy it. And he says, "I thought you didn't know how to fly." And I said, "Well, I haven't crossed that bridge yet." And he said, "Well, I know a guy down in Bethel. He's Bethel's 180 miles downriver, so it's just under a two-hour flight in that little airplane of ours, and that we had bought. And so he agreed to come up and give us lessons." So he showed up one day. He ran a barber shop down there, and he flew for an air taxi. His name was Vern Hurlburt. And if you guys have ever been in Anchorage, where you go through TSA at the Anchorage airport, he still owns that little barber shop right next to where you go into the airport. His name is Vern Hurlburt. And if you go in there and tell him you're a bush pilot, he says your first haircut's free if you're a pilot. So there's something to keep in mind. And but he came up to Sleep Mute. He showed up there, and in 3 days we did one cross country in between back down to Bethel to get my physical, and then we came back, and he says to the guy who was going to buy the airplane, he said, "Well, Vince is ready to solo." And Nixie selling me the airplane, he says, "Well, solo?" He said, "He's only been flying 3 days." And Vern says, "No, he's ready. He's got landings down really good." And then Nixie says, "Well, why don't you do one more cross country? Fly it into Anchorage, put it in his name, and do the paperwork on it. And then if he wrecks it, it's his." Wasn't a very positive recommendation on his part, but he was just protecting his own interests. And so Vern said, "Well, we could." So I talked to Mary Lowe and said, "Now he wants us to go to Anchorage for the night and do it." So that's what we did. We flew into Anchorage, got there that evening. Next morning, went to the bank, and I transferred the money into his account that we had for the airplane. It was $7,500, and we did that. And flew back to Sleep Mute, and I still had not soloed. And so my instructor, he says, "Well, how about flying me back down to Bethel?" That was another 180 miles going away from Anchorage toward the west. And I said, "Vern, I haven't even soloed yet." And he said, "Well, that can be your first solo, across country, across Alaska." And so I said, "Well, I finally agreed." "Well, all right." So that's how I that's how I got started flying. I think I only had about 20 hours at the time, but so I flew him down, and then I after school, the plane was on skis. We just learned to fly on the ice, take off the snow and the ice. It kind of cleared a little flat spot for the skis to slide around and use that for a runway, and it worked pretty good. I would go out after school and fly for a half hour, an hour, and come back and land and just build up some more time. One day I flew down to the next village, down to Red Devil, and I knew the teacher down there, and his wife was the sister of the guy I bought the airplane from, and Nixie's mom and her mom was the elderly lady in our village, and her name was Nani. And just lo and behold, it happened that Nani had jumped into a snowmobile sled on the back of a snow machine and went down to that village the same day that I flew down. It was only 8 miles down to Red Devil. And she went in to visit Catherine, her daughter, who was the wife of the school teacher I was visiting, John Murphy. And so while in there, she sees me there. She comes right in the living room. She says, "Oh, Vince, I didn't know you were here." I said, "Yeah." She says, how you get here? And I said, "Well, Nani, I flew down." She says, "Oh, good. I ride back with you." And I said, "Oh, sorry, Nani." I says, "I cannot take you. I'm just a student pilot. And I don't have my license yet." She says, "Oh, that's okay." She says, "I watch you fly. You good pilot." And I says, "Well, that's not it, Nani. I can fly the airplane, but I don't have a license." She says, "Oh, okay." So she left. Well, about an hour later, it was starting to get dark there, and probably was still February by then, I guess, maybe March. And she says, anyway, so I left, and I went out on the river, and got in the airplane, or opened the door, and there she is sitting in the back seat of my airplane. And I says, "Nani, I told you I cannot take you. I don't have a license." She says, "No, you have to." I says, "No, I don't have to." She says, "No, you have to." She said, "The snowmobile already go home. I didn't want to ride in the bumpy sled all the way back to Sleep Butte." And I says, "Oh." So I thought, well, I can't hardly throw this old lady out of my airplane, and she doesn't have a ride back down to Sleep Butte. Nobody else would probably take her. So she was my first passenger as a solo, and I really wasn't even legal because I didn't have my license, but I flew her home, dropped her off, and then flew over to school where I could park the plane for the night. And so she was my first passenger. Well, guess who my second passenger was? The next day, my wife Mariel says, "Well, if you took Nani, I want you to take me, you know." She says, "I'm half of this airplane too, you know." And I said, "Sure, okay." So I took Mariel around, and that was a fun time to get to take her for a ride, and she was satisfied with that. And I ended up flying all the rest of the way, all the way till summer. And Vern was always going to come back and give me more lessons, but he just never got a chance. So by that time, I had 80 hours of flying, still no pilot's license, and school was out. So I had told Mariel, we talked it over, and I said, "Well, how about maybe we go back to California where we lived before, Montana, where we grew up, where our families, our moms and dads and my sisters and family was." She said, "Yeah, let's do it." And I said, "And there'll be in Long Beach, California, there's an airport there with a flight school, and they have a bunch of airplanes. I'll finish my license there." And so we agreed to do that. But we still had to get from Sleep Butte into Anchorage. So we decided to fly the plane in through Merrill Pass, through a rugged section of the mountains into Merrill Pass, and leave the airplane there. We bought a tie-down spot for a couple months so we could go down to California and get my license, which I did. I'll share one more little story. You might kind of like this one. You've all heard of the Iditarod race. Well, back in 1973, when I had this airplane and no license, the teacher in the next village up from us, Stony River, was a friend of ours named Bill Bolfer. And Bill had an airplane. He had a little Piper Pacer, a little four-seat, shorter wing plane. And he would fly down on Saturdays and meet us. So Bill said, "Hey, I'm trying to round up five guys for a basketball team to play the Air Force up at the Air Force Station at Tatalina." And it was a little Air Force Station up there with about 30, 35 guys, I'm not sure, close there. And they ran one of those radar sites up there for early aircraft warnings, so that national defense stuff. And so, but they had a gym there, but nobody else to play them because it was in the middle of nowhere. And so they had welcomed anybody who'd want to come in. So Bill said, let's go up and we'll play with these Air Force guys. So we rounded up a couple guys from Red Devil and myself and Bill Bofer and one guy from McGrath, a good-sized town about 20 miles from there, who worked at the FAA Flight Center. He was a big, tall guy there, and he was going to be our center. So picked him up. We flew the three planes into the Air Force Station and on one Saturday, and it was still February then, about mid-February, and the Air Force just welcomed us, and so they took us in, feed us lunch, and then they was going to have a basketball game in the afternoon, so we went in the locker room, we put on some shorts and shoes, and we had never played together before. We were not in good shape because we didn't have gyms in our schools, but we were five guys who played a little bit of basketball in our younger days. And so we're in there, and I saw two guys walk into the gym, and they've got striped shirts on. They were the referees, and I go, what are they for? We're just going to play a little basketball. And then pretty soon, the scoreboard lit up, and it's 0-0 on this big gym scoreboard. And what's going on here? And they said, well, you guys are playing the Air Force. I said, I don't think we're playing them, you know. And sure enough, here comes the Air Force team out. There's about 15 of them, all in uniform. It says USAF on the front, white and blue. And anyway, I'm looking at go, oh, my goodness, you know. And they do their circle around. They do their calisthenics and warm-ups, and they're doing these basketball drills. And their coach is out there, and I said, we're not a team. We can't play these guys, you know. And I went over and I talked to the coach, and I said, you know, there's just no way we can compete with that. And I said, we don't have any subs, and you've got lots of subs. And he says, well, it's just for fun. I said, I know, but so he finally gave two of his guys, put jerseys over their T-shirts over their Air Force jerseys and joined our team. But the score at the end of the first quarter, I think, was something like 22-2 or something like that. We were getting beat bad. Those guys lived in the gym, and they could shoot the eyes out of the basket, and we were already in big trouble, I could tell from the way it started from the start. But we did. We played out the game and did have a lot of fun, got out of there that afternoon. We flew back to McGrath. By the time we got back to McGrath, 20 miles away, we still had another 120-mile flight to Sleep Mute, where I lived, and Bill Bofer lived 20 miles. I was going to drop him off at 100 miles, 20 miles north of Sleep Mute at Stony River. So anyway, all that being said, we got back too late, and it was getting dark, and it was starting to snow a little bit, and we thought twice about, we knew if we flew home, it would be dark when we got there, and we didn't want to try to land on that little runway at Sleep Mute and Stony River in the dark. And the other two guys were going to Red Devil, the next village down from us. So we decided to spend the night at McGrath. Well, here's what happened. We went back and forth between they called it the Roadhouse. It was a place that had some rooms, and there was a little, more or less a bar, sandwich shop bar. I forgot the name of it, but anyway, the big moose antlers on the front. And kind of back and forth, killing the evening, we shot a little pool, and we had a beer there or two. And but here's the interesting thing. There was a poster on the door of the bar, and it said, first Iditarod race, Anchorage to Nome, dog sled race, 1,000 miles, and said, first prize, $10,000. And I said, well, that's interesting. But Richard Wilmarth, one of the guys with us, he looked at that $10,000, and he says, man, $10,000, I think I'll get in that. And we all looked at him. I says, yeah, right, Richard, like you even have any dogs. And Richard says, well, there's lots of good dogs around. And I said, well, there are, but how many do you have, you know? knowing that he didn't have any dogs. And he said, well, I could borrow them. And I said, oh, right, you know. I said, do you have a dog sled? And he said, I could borrow one. And so on the way home, the next day, it was on a Sunday morning, he stopped in Stony River, the first village we got down to. It was 100 miles from McGrath, Stony River, with no villages. And he went in there and he borrowed 6 dogs, put them in his Cessna 180, and flew home to Red Devil. And the next day, or maybe later that afternoon, he flew up to Lime Village, borrowed 6 more, took them home, and then made a trip the next day down below Antioch. That's probably 120 miles downriver from Red Devil, to a village called Kalskag, and borrowed another half a dozen dogs there and a sled. He tied the sled on the outside of his airplane and flew it back to Red Devil and hooked them all up and started running this dog team. And he showed up. I was teaching school the next day, and I heard all these dogs barking, and I looked, and up over the bank come this 18 dogs all hooked to a dog sled with my friend Richard Wilmarth on the back. And my school kids thought it was the funniest thing they ever saw, seeing Richard on the back of this dog sled. They all ran over to the classroom windows, threw the sash up, and Richard, the dogs were getting tangled, and Richard was saying words he shouldn't be used around a school. I guess you'd say he's cussing at them. And they were laughing. But Richard came in and visited with the kids for a few minutes, and then he got back on the dog sled, and away he went training these dogs. He had 1 week to train this dog team. He went down to Antioch, 100 miles down and back, and then he had to be in Anchorage a week before the race to run this dog sled race. So he shows up in Anchorage a week before, got registered for the race, and the race starts on the first Saturday in March. They have a big doings downtown, and a lot of people come out and watch them start, and then they take off for heading all the way to Nome. It's actually, I think, about 1,150 miles or something like that in reality. Well, anyway, by the time they got to McGrath, where we had played basketball, that's about halfway to Nome, not quite halfway. He was already about 2 days behind all the leaders, these other guys that race all the time. But up north, and in fact, he called me on the radio and he said, Vince, I'm dropping a dog. You have to come get one of my dogs because I have to take care of somebody to take care of all my dogs. That's the race rules. So I flew up to McGrath, got his dog, a husky dog, Malamute husky, and put him in the plane and flew him back home and took care of him till Richard got back after the race. But Richard went on, and it was hard going in there. Back then, the trail was not marked real well. Lots of overflow of wet water on the side of the river where the river had risen up, and it was cold. Pretty soon, I don't know, after another week or so, most of the mushers reached the town called Unalakleet. If you look on a map, you'll see Unalakleet is the first town you hit on the coast, way up in the northwest coast on Norton Sound. And from there, it's only about another, I think, I'm going to guess, 150 miles, maybe 200, around Norton Sound till you get to Nome. And so we heard on the radio, we could get radio at night, no TV out there, but we got radio. And we heard that Richard Wilmarth, or the other mushers, came in first. And they had held up in Unalakleet waiting on the weather to get better. The winds were blowing straight out of the north at 30 to 40 miles an hour with a 30 below, 40 below wind chill factor. So they held up. Well, Richard, in those 2 days, gave him a chance. He caught up with the race, caught up with the 5 leaders in Unalakleet. And when he pulled in, he signed the check-in and pulled on out into the storm ahead of him. And the other guys, they'd said, well, let him go. He's just going to go out and camp because he's just come over the longest, hardest stretch of the race that there is. And so away he went. And he kept going through the night. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, all the other four mushers or five mushers who were there in Unalakleet, they were all woken up. I think it was about 2 or 3 in the morning. And they said, "Hey, you guys, we just got heard on a radio call that Richard Wilmarth is in the village of Shaktulik." And that's another, I don't remember, 30 miles or more, 40, I'm not sure the distance, but up the coast, the next village up the coast anyway. And he's got, and they're going, "Holy smokes." He kept going. They didn't think he would go that far. So they all ran out and hooked up to try and catch him. And now the race is on. We're listening to it for the next couple of days. And it was getting close to the day before, and that one announcer, I distinctly remember him saying, he said, "Well, Richard Wilmarth has a good chance of winning that race if he can maintain the same pace, because they're gaining on him, but he has a good chance to be the first one into Nome." So once we heard that, everybody that knew, has an airplane from our area, all decided to fly up to Nome to watch the end of this race. And Mary Lowell and I did too. But we took Bill Bofor along. He was our friend from Stony River, so there was a pilot. But
and that was Vince Spady of Soldata of Alaska. I hope you're having a great week. This has been Pastor Matthew. That was part one. Next week we'll have part two. Have a great week, and remember, God loves you. Let's finish off with the last lick of "Because He Lives." Because Jesus does live. Amen. And life is worth a living just because He lives. He
Hi, back with you again here after a short pause. I just wanted to say that when we heard that Richard Wilmarth had a chance of winning, when we all decided to, many of us decided to fly our planes up there, so that's what we did. We took off, and I think it was a Friday evening, and we headed for Nome. And by the time we got going, we only made it to Unalakleet that night, and we were still a couple hours out of Nome. But I gassed up there at the air taxi and the flight service station there in Unalakleet. There were three of us, myself and Bill Bofor and Murray Lill and I in our airplane. And the flight service guy said, "I wouldn't go on to Nome tonight if I were you guys. It's going to be snowing up there, and it's going to be dark, and it's hard to follow that coast in the dark with the clouds because it blocks all the light, and I would wait till morning." So as much as we wanted to be there when the race would probably end, we thought safety first. We better spend the night in Unalakleet. And Unalakleet's a big village. I don't know. 1,500 people or something like that, as villages go. And so Bill said, "I've got a friend that lives here. So you and Mary Lou are on your own to find a spot to stay." And I said, "Well, no problem." So I thought, we'll just go over to the school. When we're in the village, people want to look for a place to stay. They come see us. And so we went to the school. And by the time we got to the school, the janitor was just locking the door, and I said, "Is there any teachers left in there?" And he says, "Oh, no, they let them all out early because of the Iditarod, and they all went home early." And I said, "Oh, okay." So we didn't have that option. And then so I said, "Well, let's go check the hotel, the roadhouse," and went in there. And he says, "We already are triple booked in every room." And I said all we need is just a place to maybe sleep on the floor if we could. You know, we just need a place out there. He says, "We've already rented out all of our floor space. We cannot take any more people." There were race officials and veterinarians and newspaper people. Seemed like it would be the worst time in the world to get a room at Unalakleet is when the Iditarod's going through there. So I said, "Well, okay, we'll see what we can find." So Mary Lowell and I, I said, I got an idea. Let's go to the post office, because when we first got to the Sleep Mute, there was a fellow from Unalakleet who was a postmaster trainer, and he had come to Sleep Mute for 3 days to train a new postmaster, because our other one, I think, got fired for taking money from the till or something there. But so he stayed with us, and Mary Lowell cooked for him, and we gave him a room to stay in. And so the last thing he said was, if you're ever in Unalakleet, give me a call. So I thought, well, let's give him a call. And so we didn't have his number. I said, well, let's go by the post office and see if we can find him. Well, there he was. His name is Fred Ryan, a brother to the Ryan Brothers Aircraft, if you've heard of them, Ryanair. And my wife is, she was sneaking in on me, asking me for where my wallet was. She needed a little money there, so you get a little home stuff here. But I forgot where I was talking to you. We were at Fred Ryan there, and I said, hi, Fred. And I said, well, remember when you were in Sleep Mute and you said, if we ever need a place to stay? I said, well, we need a place to stay. And Fred says, oh, man. And I said, Fred, that doesn't sound pretty good. He said, well, it's just that, he said, just with this race going on, he said, my brother-in-law and his family's here from upriver, and they're staying in our house. My sister's here from St. Michael's. They're staying in our house, and some other friends were staying there. He says, anyway, last night, he said, we had 28 visitors in my house, and we have a small house. And so he said, oh, and I said, well, I don't know, Fred. I said, I can't stay out there. It's 40 below wind chill factor out there, and I can't sleep outside, so I don't know what else to do. And he said, I know. He said, you can stay at my brother's house. He says, my brother just lives outside on the edge of town out there. And he said, he's a single guy, and nobody's staying with him. And I says, well, that's fine, except I don't know your brother. And he says, oh, he'd be fine with it. He said, here's how you get there. And he told me, hit the slough, turn right, count three houses, and that'll be his on the right. So anyway, I said, well, all right, we'll have to do that. And so Mary Lowell and I said, let's walk around for a while, because I don't want to. Oh, he also told me that he won't be home till about 5 o'clock at night, because he's out trapping, but he'll be home because he wants to take this girl to the Native Association social event and dance meeting or something. And he said, but I know he'll come back because he likes this girl and he'll be there. And so we thought, well, we could walk around for an hour and a half out there until he comes home, because I didn't want to go in his house before he got there. So we went out and I walked to the airplane and put on the wing covers, put on my engine cover, and put my little catalytic heater under the engine so it would be warm in the morning. Got the airplane tied down, basically put to bed. And we walked around, but after about a half hour, we were chilled to the bone in that cold and the wind. So I said, let's see if we can find that house. And we walked over, counted the three houses, and I said, this has got to be it. And so we knocked on the door, no one was home. So I opened the door and stepped inside, and there was a big rectangular space heater with an oil heater, and it was so warm, and it was like 80 degrees in there. And we says, oh, that feels so good. So we stood by that for a while and warmed up, so pretty soon we took our coats off and got warm. And I said, well, if he's going to be home at 5, what do you say we take a walk about a quarter to 5 so we can come knock on the door when he's there, so we're not in his house? And Mario said, good idea. So we put our coats on and just got ready to go, and here snowmobile pulled up right in front. I mean, like 10 feet in front of the door, and stopped. I said, oh, no, he's home. I hear him stomping his boots out, and he came through the Arctic entry porch and stomping his boots a little more. And he comes in, and I said, hi. I kind of wave at him, and he waves at me, hi. As he turns, and he walked right in the bedroom without saying another word to me, and I'm holding out my hands like, you know, I didn't even get to say who I was or what was there. And I said, I'm thinking, is he going to get a gun or something? But next thing I heard a shower going in there. So he's in the shower, and about 20 minutes later, he comes out, and he's dressed in a nice leather coat, and he looks really sharp. And he's going back to this, his date, you might say. And he's going out the door as fast as he came in. And I finally just hollered at him and said, your brother Fred wanted to know if we could stay with you. And he says, oh, yeah, make yourself at home. I'll be home at 10. And zoom, he was gone. So that fast, he disappeared. So we stayed in there until he got home at night. And he came back about... probably 10 o'clock at night, somewhere there. And I asked him, I said, well, and he was real friendly. I said, weren't you worried when you came in and some strangers in your home? And he says, no, not too much. He says, but I do remember I was in the shower and I'm thinking, who are those people? And so anyway, he says, yeah, here the bed makes out to a little folding bed, or the couch makes out into a folding bed. And so he got up in the morning and fed us breakfast, and off we went. So he was good to us. And well, anyway, to wind this story down and end it, we took off for Nome in the morning, and we passed a couple dog teams on the way that were some of those that were in Unalakleet at the time hadn't made it in yet. And but during the night, Richard Wilmarth made it into McGrath, and although it was close, he was the first winner of the race, and he actually ended up winning $12,000. So it was fun to be a part of that, and so that was kind of a highlight of ours to get to go to Nome and do that in the very first Iditarod. So I'm going to wind down, say thank you guys for listening. I'm over the time. I'm not sure how we'll work it in. I know it's longer than one program. But anyway, it's a pleasure getting to speak to you, and hope I get to speak to you again sometime. So may the good Lord bless you and keep you. And with that, I'll say goodbye. So thank you. Bye.
Part two of Vince Spady. You also got to hear a little bit of part one. I'm so thankful he was able to share with you. This has been Pastor Matthew. This is Safe Harbor Church. Get ready. Our Easter editions are coming up. I hope you're blessed, and I hope you tune in. And let's look forward to celebrating the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. God bless you. I'll see you next time on Hour of Hope. Bye.